Principles of Economics, My Complete Guide to Understanding Economics, is now available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from SaifEddin.com, Amazon, and many more booksellers worldwide. And now, I am also teaching a course based on this book on my website, SaifEddin.com. Principles of Economics will run the whole academic year, from September to June, and will have a new lecture every 2 weeks, as well as weekly live online discussion seminars open to learners from all over the world and from all walks of life. Whether you're a student, a professional, or a retiree, you are making economic decisions every day, and this course will arm you with the wisdom of centuries of economists to improve your economic decision-making. You'll also get a free book of Principles of Economics if you sign up for the course. Go to SaifEddin.com and sign up now. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by Orange Pill App, the Bitcoin-only social network that connects you with high-signal Bitcoiners, events, and now merchants as well. If you're like me and can't stop talking about Bitcoin, you know how challenging it can be to talk to the no-coiners and how nice it is to talk to someone who gets you. With the Orange Pill app, you can find the Bitcoiners near you and they can replace the no-coiners in your life. You can organize events and meetups with local Bitcoiners, and wherever you travel, you can meet up with local Bitcoiners all while being as anonymous as you like. So if you want to build your local network of Bitcoiners, find a Bitcoin meetup or merchants accepting Bitcoin, head over to orangepillapp.com to sign up or download the app from the App Store or Google Play Store and send me a DM so we can get connected. The Bitcoin Standard Podcast is brought to you by CoinKite. CoinKite are my favorite makers of Bitcoin hardware. They produce the legendary OpenDime, the first Bitcoin bearer asset, as well as the reliable Cold Card hardware wallet, the excellent stainless steel seed plates for storing your seed phrases, and the block clock. Now, CoinKite have produced the Sats card, a card the size of a credit card which can store Bitcoin and works great as a gift. CoinKite have just produced a limited edition gorgeous Bitcoin Standard Sats card, which carries the Bitcoin Standard logo, and you can get it from coinkite.shop/Bitcoin Standard. Use the code Bitcoin Standard to get 5% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by the Bitcoin Way, your professional Bitcoin IT team offering you personalized, secure, and comprehensive solutions for every step along your Bitcoin journey. The Bitcoin Way offer live concierge service to guide you with your Bitcoin cold storage, running your node, privacy best practices, inheritance planning, corporate strategy, and multi-sig solutions. They don't touch your coins, they guide you through the process of acquiring your coins and securing them. If you'd like to make your setup safer and more reliable, book a consult with them and see what they have to suggest. If you want to give someone the gift of Bitcoin, get them this professional service that will ensure they start off knowing exactly how to manage their coins and not lose them. Go to thebitcoinway.com and start Bitcoining more confidently. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast. Our guest today is Lana Nagornaya. Lana is a trader and investor with over 16 years of experience in trading stocks, options, futures, and other financial instruments. In 2020, she founded the Lana Invest School to teach people about economics and how to obtain financial freedom. Her platform currently has around 30,000 students enrolled worldwide. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me here. It is really an honor for me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you. Wanted to get you on here to basically get a sense of fiat user experience for somebody living in Russia today. And given your background and, you know, your expertise and your website, clearly you're very familiar with issues of money and banking and the digital currencies as well. So I thought it would be a very interesting discussion to have on just how things have affected you over the last few months, how things have changed. From the perspective, really think about it as if I'm asking you to review, you know, your switch from Windows to Mac, or Mac to Windows, or Mac to Linux. This is kind of how I wrote the Bitcoin Standard. You know, I explained Bitcoin as an engineering system, and then in the Fiat Standard, I apply the same lens to studying the Fiat monetary system. And so, you know, I wrote the Fiat Standard in 2020 and 2021. And then it got published, and really it explained the system as a US centric system, that basically all these other central banks are essentially running a dollar backed currency, and they need the dollar and they need to work with the US system, and they use the SWIFT mechanism for clearance. And that US Federal Reserve, effectively the only full node in the fiat system. So what I find really interesting is that, you know, a few months later, we get this international conflict, which, you know, it's obviously extremely horrific and horrible to watch unfold, this senseless war. What I'd like to focus on discussing is the economic implications from the monetary standpoint, because we saw sanctions being imposed on Russia, and we're wondering really what is it that is going to, how is that going to reflect on the experience of your average Russian fiat user? So perhaps let's begin with, tell us how things were before the war. You know, back in 2021, what was it like for you when you wanted to send and receive money abroad from Russia and domestically as well? Like, what was your experience with money there?
Well, if to start before the war, what it was before, it was pretty normal, you know? It was pretty okay. I would like to start from the Russian economy, what it was and what it is now. So before, you know, the Russian economy, like any other country, is characterized by gross domestic product, GDP. According to the World Bank, Russia is the 11th in the world and the 5th in Europe in terms of nominal GDP. If to compare Russia's GDP simply by converting it from the local currency, we have rubles, to US dollars, we will get an economy the size of Spain. But it's, of course, incorrect to compare two countries so different in size and their economies. In terms of numbers, the Russian economy is like the Spanish economy, but there is a catch. The standard of living in Russia is much lower than in Spain. The population's purchasing power is lower, despite the fact that we are a major exporter of resources. How does Russia's economy differ from the, for example, other countries? Our main difference is the focus on exports. And it's important because about export, we will talk with you about when we will talk about the war. What happened with export after the 24th of February? So remember this. We are very export country. Second of all, Russian resources and production. Of course, the first thing that comes to mind when one thinks of the Russian economy is natural resources. Russia is the world's largest exporter of natural gas and the second largest exporter of oil. Therefore, we are directly dependent on the volume of raw materials we produce and their prices. Importers of our resources, primarily Europe, United States, and Asia. And, you know, in addition to resource extraction, Russia has a well-developed industrial sector. It is around 30% of our GDP. In this respect, the Russian economy is closer to Chinese economy than, for example, to the American economy, which is more service-oriented. And by the way, for example, the year 2020 showed us that countries with strong industrial predictionary felt better during the crisis than economies that are based on services. So in this respect, Russia looks more resilient to crisis than many other countries. On the other hand, dependence on natural resources makes Russia vulnerable. And in this respect, we are more dependent on energy prices and exports. And during the current geopolitical situation, this dependence, you see, it is very obvious. And third of all, Russia is an exporting country, as I said before, and we have an exporting economy. Oil and gas sales provide about 50% of Russia's budget and up to 60% of its exports. So as you can see, the current Western sanctions against the oil and gas industry are extremely sensitive for us. What happens after the sanctions that were announced? Europe and the US impose a phenomenal package of sanctions. You know that right now Russia suffers from the dramatic number of sanctions ever. That was never happened before, and I hope never happened again. But right now, it's a phenomenon. Oil and gas exports from Russia are reduced, but there is always, you know, some buts. But since Russia, with its resources, has a great weight in the world, the reduction of their supplies leads to an increase in oil and gas prices that compensates the decreased volumes. So you see, right now, Russia, from some analytics, even she didn't lose anything. No such significant problems. Price on in oil and gas compensates everything.
Yeah, and I think particularly the oil and gas sector over the last few years had suffered an enormous crisis, particularly in 2020. You know, there was a time in which even spot oil price became negative, not just future oil, but even spot oil became negative, you know, when the whole world was shut down. So the oil industry obviously had to cut down drastically its investments, and it had to also become much more efficient. So whatever is left from the oil industry after the carnage of 2020 today is extremely lean and extremely efficient. And so as any kind of crisis leads to increases in energy prices, and you know, energy sources are fungible. You can shift from one to the, I mean, not very easily, obviously there's infrastructure, but people can shift between different sources depending on demand, that they adjust certain infrastructure to adjust for certain fuels. So when one fuel's price rises, all the other ones also rise. And so therefore, yeah, it ends up being enormously beneficial to producers when these kind of crises happen. But yeah, I think...
And I wanted to add about something about Russian economy. You know, we have very interesting issue. Everyone knows about oil and gas, but not many people know that we also sell metals very well. A few companies that export metals, for example, nickel and titanium. And this is very interesting because, you see, titanium production is very rare. Russia is a key supplier of titanium in the world. And there is no country in the world who can replace Russia in this market. And processed titanium for the American nuclear plants is supplied mostly by Russia. The only that was not touched by sanctions is titanium, because it's impossible to replace by anybody else. And yeah, it's, you know, and it's very interesting about sanctions. You see, so tricky moment.
Yes, I think this seemed pretty much unthinkable throughout the, well, not really unthinkable. There were always people who were saying, you know, the Russians and the Chinese are going to break away from the US dollar system and set up their own. And it was never credible because they never did it. You know, yes, the Russians and the Chinese have accumulated gold a lot over the last couple of decades as people started to lose confidence in the US dollar, but they still more or less relied on the US dollar. And it took this kind of crisis to get the Russian economy off of this, but surprisingly, you know, for most people, I would say it's extremely surprising that it has not been catastrophic for the Russian economy. And as you explained, it is because of the energy resources. And I think an important aspect here, of course, is that a lot of the US and European economies, in my opinion, has just become over-financialized bullshit, really. You know, the fiat economy is just government printing money and handing it out to people who help get you elected. So there's an entire complex, which, you know, I call the fiat cartel. All of these banks and companies and finance and consulting and media and a lot of the jobs in the Western world, which, you know, are very self-important, that people think that what they're doing is extremely important, but really they don't survive because people pay their salaries, because people view them as important. They survive because government prints money, forcibly devalues the salary of everybody else, and therefore allows them to continue. You know, if you're going to run a fiat monetary system that's a monopoly for the world, you can't afford to have too much of this. You know, you have to have some people making titanium and gas and oil in order for you to be able to punish defectors like the Russians, I would say. Like, if you want to make it expensive for a country like Russia to think that, you know, getting kicked off the SWIFT network and the Fed network is really expensive, then, you know, you need to be able to step in, and you and your allies need to be able to make up for all of their gas and oil and titanium and all these other supplies. And, you know, this was, of course, entirely possible, I think, under the Soviet era. And, you know, the world was not reliant on Soviet industry as much as it is, because Soviet industry was largely dysfunctional. But now it seems exporting real things matters more than exporting feelings and reports.
Business is business, you know.
Yeah. So what is it like from your perspective in terms of, you know, the user experience? How have things changed for you? It was pretty straightforward before 2022 for you to send and receive money abroad, just as a regular Russian person through a bank account. The syllabus for my new online economics course, Principles of Economics, is now available on saifedean.com. The course will take place over 18 lectures, each based on one chapter from my new book, Principles of Economics, which will be available for free as an ebook for everyone registering for the course. Lectures will be released once every 2 weeks on Mondays, starting on the 25th of September, 2023, and will be available in video and audio format. Live discussion seminars will be held once a week on Thursdays at alternating time slots, 12 hours apart, to ensure learners can attend from all over the world. I'm happy to announce that I have set up my new publishing house and online bookstore, The Safe House, which will be publishing and delivering the best Bitcoin and Austrian economics books worldwide in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook formats. Go to thesafehouse.com to buy my latest book, Principles of Economics, as well as the Fiat Standard and the Bitcoin Standard. And now I'm also publishing Fiat Food, Matthew Lisiak's amazing investigation into how inflation ruined our diet and health. And I'm also publishing Lynn Alden's Broken Money, her masterful exploration of the failures of the global financial system and how Bitcoin fixes it. This is a Bitcoiner's bookshop, so the books are printed in beautiful cloth hardcover made to last, with an ice-colored dust jacket on top. Go to thesafehouse.com and get yours now.
Well, right now, you know that a lot of our banks are cut off from SWIFT system. So We can't use the SWIFT system. Therefore, we can't transfer money abroad. And for most of Russian people, it didn't affect it at all, because they live in Russia, they spend money in Russia, they travel among Russia, so nothing happened about SWIFT system. Who suffered more? People who, you know, middle class. People who prefer to travel, to buy some goods, because right now we don't have even import. Nothing is going to Russia. We can buy anything. I don't say about, you know, some goods for home, for, you know, clothes or something like this. Car suppliers, a lot of supplying for fabrics, and a lot of other stuff that affect our internal economy. If to say about regular people, you know that a lot of companies went from Russian market. Some of them made it because of logistic, because right now it's impossible to deliver something to Russia. That's why they stopped the operational of their businesses in Russia. Some of the companies stopped the operational because of, you know, ethical issues. It's the kind of protest against the war that Russia started. But I will tell you from my perspective, from my family. I was born and raised in St. Petersburg. It's Russia, at the second city in Russia. It's not very far from Moscow. And when I was a child, in front of my house, there was a forest. And approximately 25 years ago, instead of this forest, IKEA built a huge factory, a huge store. You know how IKEA loves this store, they're hugest. And instead of the forest, there were an IKEA. 25 years later, IKEA went from the Russian market. This is the house of my parents. Before IKEA came to Russia, my parents had a furniture from Czechoslovakia. 25 years later, after IKEA were gone from Russia, my parents still have the furniture from Czechoslovakia. There is no IKEA anymore. There is no Czechoslovakia anymore, but furniture in the apartment of my parents. So for the regular people, for the ordinary people, nothing happens. Yes, we can't buy IKEA, we can't buy Zara or something like this.
But here's the question is, what has happened to that IKEA store? Like, has it been taken over by a Russian company and they're still selling the same kind of furniture, but with a different name?
Right now, they stopped. They just, you know, postponed. Oh. They still pay salaries to the employees. And it's very good of them. Thank them so much. A lot of companies who stop business in Russia, They just stopped. They didn't gone. They pay salaries, support the employees, and it's really good sign. It's really good. We don't know how long top. It's approximately 350,000 families who will lose their job, or who will lose their money. And this is the problem. Not because of the goods. Problem because of these places. Because, you know, and there will be no place to go. There is no chance to replace this position. For example, somebody works as a manager in IKEA. And there is no place to go for him because all other companies are gone. You see, this is the problem. And this affects...
I think I heard something about McDonald's, that there's just all the Russian McDonald's turned into a new restaurant with a new name, and all the same people are working there, but they're just not paying money to McDonald's anymore.
A few companies sold their businesses to the Russian players. Let's say it like this, the Russian players, and nobody revealed the value of these deals, but I suppose it was not the market price. And it was just sold. It was sold with everything inside. The one thing that the business took with them, the name. So right now we don't have McDonald's. We have It's Tasty and Dot. So, you know, different name, but everything is the same. The same kitchen, the same cuisine, you know, but different name.
What's the quality like? Has it changed? Really, it's a very interesting thought experiment. Like, what would happen if a company, if a country just goes, you know, we're going to keep running, you know, it's all Russian people running the McDonald's in Russia anyway. It's all German people in Germany. It's all South Africa people in South Africa. So if they just keep running the business without paying royalties to McDonald's, how does it work? How's the quality?
Well, right now, there were some issues about quality in the beginning. And the new business owners, he promised that will never repeat again, that everything will be okay and will be the high quality for sure. But in the beginning, there were problems. Right now, everything is okay. They improved the quality. I hope it will be the same. Nobody knows, you know?
Yeah. So I know there have been sanctions, but obviously there are still companies that are trading with the rest of the world. Obviously, Russia is not cut off completely from the rest of the world. So there are companies that still import and export things. There are people making payments to other things. How is that working? Do you have any insight you can share with us on how these companies or individuals are managing to trade with the rest of the world?
It's dropped significantly. We don't have import. We don't have export. We have export only of some, can't use SWIFT transactions. That's why we sell gas and oil only for rubles. And the system works like this. So right now, when we sell it, the company who buy, the foreign company, they have to open the bank account in Gazprom Bank, so in Russian bank, and to transfer money, to transfer rubles to this account. After that, we can sell gas and oil. Not all the European countries agreed with this. And this is the reason why right now the crisis not only in Russia, but in the whole Europe. Because a lot of countries didn't agree to buy gas and oil for rubles. You can understand Russia. You have a contract, you have to sell it, you have to deliver it, and there is no money for you. So it was maybe not fair for Europe, but it was like win-win, but vice versa. So they cut off our SWIFT transactions. We said, okay, we will deliver only for rubles. You see, it's very tricky moment.
So where is the global market for rubles taking place? How do you cash out those rubles? I mean, there has to be a market where people are buying rubles and selling them in order for trade to take place between people who don't have rubles and people who have them.
Okay, let's tell you a little bit about our Russian rubles and what happened with it since the 24th of February. So following of Russia's invasion to Ukraine, USD to ruble exchange rate fell significantly. It reached approximately 135 rubles in March 2022 because of decreased imports and limitations on foreign currency trade and withdrawals. So the central bank more than doubled the country's key interest rate to a huge 20%, up from 9.5%. And, you know, introduced a shield to its financial system from sanctions. Since then, the currency's value has improved to over 7-year highs in late June, reaching 50-55 rubles against the US dollar, making it the world's, you know, best performing currency in 2022. The growth of the ruble was represented by Russian authorities as an evidence of economical strength, that everything is okay. You see what a wonderful ruble we have. It is so strong, but you should understand that it's very artificial. The strength of the currency doesn't mean that the Russian economy is healthy or, for example, immune to the effects of sanctions. This strong ruble means that imports have fallen so sharply that importers no longer need as much foreign currency as before, because they can no longer import goods from Western countries. I think, and it's my opinion, that the market will continue to, you know, to wait for government measures to prevent excessive ruble appreciation and, I don't know, further easing of the central bank's interest rate policy. And I suppose by the end of the year, I expect the dollar exchange rate to be close to 70-75 rubles. So to return to your question, right now, of course, we have currency exchange. We can change currency on the market, but it is artificial rate right now. It's not the real situation. And I know that importers or exporters who still have some contracts, they don't use exactly this exchange currency rate. They use something else, but nobody knows which one. But in Russia, regular people can go to the market, the exchange market, and buy some dollars, buy some euro to sell rubles, to sell dollars and all this stuff. But you know that we have a lot of restrictions right now. For example, we can withdraw not more than $10,000 cash.
That's more than Americans.
At all.
Well, not exactly, but I mean, there are restrictions on cash, basically, I think. I don't think in the US, but in many European countries, they do have restrictions on dollars. But you don't have these restrictions on rubles?
No, of course not.
Okay.
But, you know, everything that is more than 10,000, you will get only in rubles.
Okay.
And it was very sudden. So for a lot of people, for example, me, I don't live in Russia. I live in Europe. And just in one day, it was like this. I have money on my bank card, on my account. But I don't have money I don't have money at all, because I live in Europe. VIF doesn't work. Visa and MasterCard don't work anymore. So cards that were issued in Russia, they work only within the country. So you can't pay. For example, I live in Malta. I can't pay in the restaurant with my card. I can't do anything with my card. Only I can pay for something when I come to Russia. So you see, we have a lot of restrictions, some new rules, and they happened all of a sudden. And it was very shock.
Yeah, so basically there is a liquid market for dollars and euros in Russia. It's possible to buy them. And the exchange rate is freely determined, right? There are no restrictions. You get the same rate that you see on the internet. It's not like you walk into the shop. Yeah, same rate. But there are restrictions on, you said, with imports and exports. Do they impose different rates on them? Do you know if these are lower or higher? How does it work?
What is higher? It is higher.
It is higher. So like a Russian exporter is basically having to take dollars at around 75, 80 maybe, rather than 60, 55?
Yeah, I think so. Because right now the market rate is 60, 61 right now. So it's not very high. And the last time it was 60, I don't know, 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. So you see.
Well, that's fascinating. And so how has this isolation affected people in Russia economically? So you're saying you are in Malta now, you're not in Russia?
I don't live in Russia since 2016, I have a lot of relatives there. I have business there. And so I know everything about Russia.
Okay, so how has the fact that, you know, imports have declined enormously, how has that affected the Russian economy? How has the difference been felt at the supermarket?
Right now, everything looks normal. For regular people, For example, I told to my parents, I told to my friends, it's a wonderful summer. Everybody, you know, spend their best life. Nothing really affected regular people. If we talk about people, if we talk about the economy, crisis right now that didn't affect it so much to regular Russian people yet. But I suppose we will see the real effect maybe in the fall or winter. So in the end of this year, I think we will see something because prices are high right now. And it's obvious why. We don't have import. Nothing goods are coming to our country. That's why everything that we have, all the prices raised dramatically, very high. And right now it's only half a year of all this special war operation. But I think in the end of the year, we will see the real result.
Oh, so you think there have been large price increases this year in Russia?
Right now, yes. Consumer? Yes.
Yeah.
It's starting.
Starting. So even though the ruble may have appreciated, but it's still real foods and real goods and services have appreciated more, I guess, and which makes sense because a lot of the world's trade supplies are getting disrupted by this war, in particular around Russia. So you would expect that this would happen. But has it reached the point where it is becoming a serious problem, a serious political problem? Has inflation become a serious political problem? Or is it still understood that, well, you know, we're fighting a war and it's just a small price that we have to pay? What do you think?
You know,
it's really okay if you don't want to answer that. You can skip it. We can remove it later.
Right now, we have very high inflation, but it's not something rare for Russia. So we used to have, you know, even for me, I'm 37, but even for my age, I saw a few crises in Russia. So our people are very got used for crises. You remember Perestroika. You remember all these crises? Okay, the crisis, the previous
1998.
Crisis. 1998, yes. 2014, we had a lot of crises. So I think, in my opinion, right now, for the regular people, for the just, you know, for all the Russians, it's like, it's something that's not unique. Something that happened before and maybe will happen again. But right now, okay, we will have very high prices. But our government, they hope, will do something. And if to, you know, to return to, you asked about how to buy rubles, how to buy euro and all the currencies. Right now, Russians have money. We worked hard all these years. Everybody had money. So we had a lot of companies that provided employees. It was really a good time. And a lot of people right now have some money, some savings. And right now, dollar is not very, how to say, popular because they froze our, you know what America made, they froze our assets. It was the red flag for the whole world that it can happen. Russians don't buy dollars because we don't have import. We have nothing to buy for dollars. Everything that we can buy by rubles. And right now, it is very interesting for Russian people to diversificate their money, their savings in yuan. Russian people started to buy yuan, and it started very popular. We even have bonds in yuan on Moscow Exchange. So, you know, it's some kind of de-dollarization, if you can say this word. In Russia, it is happening right now.
That's really fascinating. Coming to my next question, which is Russia-Chinese relations have not been massively impacted by this war. Russia and China still trade, and India, for instance, still buying energy from Russia. So this is reviving talk of BRICS as being a serious monetary alternative rather than just politicians getting together as building a kind of alternative system. And you already have Iran, which has been on the sanctions list for a very long time and has been
30 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you have Iran and now Russia having to do this, then you're getting some serious kind of motivation behind it. And with the Chinese playing an increasingly important role in the global economy and their currency playing a more important role, do you see this becoming realistic? And do you see it coming to the point where, you know, individuals and companies begin to use Chinese banks and Chinese currency for trading with China and perhaps even with the rest of the world?
It is happening right now. And let's tell to our viewers that central bank, our Russian central bank, has been hit by toughest sanctions ever. Foreign assets have been frozen, as I said before. And this is, by the way, was almost 40% of the bank's total assets. Therefore, the freezing of Russian reserves in US dollars, in euros, will have, you know, long life lasting effect, both for Russia and the rest of the world. This fact that Russian foreign reserves are blocked has become, as I said before, a kind of a, you know, a red flag for many countries that now reconsider the idea of the dollar's reliability as a reserve currency. The process of this de-dollarization right now is taking place in Russia and in China, where the pace of selling off, debt in US dollars is accelerating. Moreover, it's very interesting. China and Saudi Arabia have recently discussed the changing of currency payment from dollars to yuan for Saudi oil. So it is starting right now. If to speak about the total de-dollarization, of course, it's impossible right now because there is nothing to replace it with. There are several points why there is no alternative to the dollar. And one of them, of course, a lot of countries use dollars because it's familiar and it's convenient for a payment. So I think that the process of de-dollarization, it is started, it has started, but it is not fast. And the Chinese economy is strong enough to offer an Asian alternative to the dollar. And I hope that you will ask me about gold.
Yes, of course. That was the next thing. This is the obvious thing. So, it sounds like it would have made sense for these countries to get together and just do this 20 years ago. This isn't the first time that, this is a very more serious level of dollar dysfunction for them. But they've always had their problem. The imbalances existed since the early 2000s because of the Chinese piling up all of these treasuries and the US essentially borrowing endlessly to finance its spending, which is allowing it to finance its military and its bullshit fiat economy and all of these extremely expensive, idiotic things that fiat money allows. But of course, the problem with just saying, I don't want to play with the US dollar is that, well, what's the alternative? You can't really do it with the Chinese currency or the Russian currency or the Indian currency, because then you're just replacing the US with India or Russia or China, and then you're just giving them that power. And so, you're not going to get all these countries to agree to leave the US to go and join another country. And so then, of course, they need a kind of monetary asset that's neutral. And the obvious choice here is gold. So how's that been doing in Russia recently?
Thank you for this question, because I have my own opinion about what's going on with the gold. And when we say about what is the alternative for the dollar, yes? And the first thing that we think about, it is gold, because it used to be. So we know everything, how it works, how it worked. And right now, that we were just saying that the dollar and the euro are losing their status. And the big question is what to hold as a reserve, right? So after all, everyone is considering changing, and fiat is not an option, as you said. And we need an underlying asset. And now gold can become the new standard. It's an asset in which many countries want to transact. And in this respect, the sanctions against Russian gold, a move by the Americans to prevent the switch from fiat to gold, is to make it clear that gold can also be vulnerable. That is, I have the idea that the main purpose of the ban of Russian gold, it's not to limit its exports, not. It's more importantly to limit the idea that once the dollar loses its status as the world currency, everyone will have to go back to gold. So the idea of exchanging oil for gold seems more dangerous to Washington than the idea of selling Russian gas for rubles or Saudi oil for Chinese currency. So Arab countries, Indonesia and Nigeria, may also want to sell their oil for gold. And there is a chance that more countries will start trying to sell other commodities for gold. Now that the dollar is no longer seen as a super secure asset, the emergence of another world currency that could compete with it becomes much, much more, you know, dangerous for the dollar than ever. And let me assume that neither the rupee nor ruble or even the Chinese currency can act in its capacity. Of course not. Right now, not. In this case, gold, which has been accepted as money for centuries, could become a serious competitor to the dollar. And if it's proven that gold is just as vulnerable to sanctions as dollar reserves, this danger can be prevented. So you see what America did? They showed the whole world, want to replace our dollar with gold? We can ban your gold. So it was like a red flag.
Yeah, this is a very important point, which is that the London Bullion Market Association is effectively the only place where you can trade gold internationally in the world in any kind of meaningful sense. And this is something that gold bugs don't really like to think about, because in their mind, you know, gold is money. It's great. You drop it on a table. It makes a sound. You know that sound. You know it's real. That's cute, you know, when you're going to buy something, you know, buying a shoe or a suit for yourself or whatever. But if you need something for a modern economy where people are trading all over the world at a very high speed, you need a mechanism for settlement. And the reality is, for the last couple of centuries, that's revolved around the London Bullion Market Association. And before that, the Bank of England, which is also reliant on the London Bullion Market Association. I mean, still basically the same institution. So if you want to trade gold internationally, you can only do it with the gold bricks that exist in that system. You can think about it as like a physical blockchain, like the structure of Bitcoin. They have all these bricks of 12.5 kilograms of gold, so about 400 ounces of gold each. They get into the system, and then they make them into uniform bars with serialized numbers. And then they have their custody in different people's names on the system. And then they trade within the system while staying in the same place. And then you can take custody of them in different places. You can cash them out. But basically, that's really the way that gold gets traded internationally. And so this year, the London Bullion Market Association stopped accepting Russian gold, which basically makes it very difficult for the Russian central bank to use gold as a monetary asset, because you can't just sell it to the London Bullion Market Association and take cash easily and then use that cash to, you know, take dollars to settle trade. But of course, you know, gold is gold. So you can still sell it in other places. And it seems to be shifting to China now, right?
Yes, yes. And don't forget about that Russian gold had 10% of the whole market. So it's a lot.
Yeah. You know, what are the realistic options of actually seeing a gold-based monetary system emerge in China and Russia? I mean, let's be realistic here. At the end of the day, these governments aren't likely to want to have a gold standard, because a gold standard severely limits their ability to spend money. And so if gold standard is the price that they have to pay to have a functional system that is a functional alternative to the US dollar, I'm not sure that they're ready to pay it, because that requires a lot of monetary and fiscal discipline.
Yes,
what do you think?
Yes. I totally agree with you, because I don't know how to monitor about that. Yes, because right, you know, population is growth every year. And how are they going to monitor all this stuff? I have no idea. Dollar was and is very comfortable. So it's, you know, it's very popular because it's easy to monitor, it's easy to transfer and all this stuff. Because, you know, gold, it's heavy, at least it's heavy. So I rather doubt that gold can replace dollar. So we will see what will going on.
Yeah, it's still very difficult, because I think what I try and explain in the fiat standard is, if you try and think of running the global world economy today with physical bars of gold flying around, it's going to be extremely expensive and extremely cumbersome. And I think the main thing is that it's extremely insecure. This is the problem. If you can hear a gold coin But with the gold bars, which, you know, to go back to the issue earlier, with the gold bars, if you want to have serious trade being happening on gold, you need to use the London Bullion Market Association, because you need to be trading 12 and a half kilograms of gold. And these things, you can't just drop them on a table and go by the sound. That doesn't work. First of all, it's going to break your table, most likely. And you need something a little bit more reliable, because, you know, you're talking about $750,000 roughly in a small little brick. So to do that, the only way to verify one of these bars is you have to melt it down and verify that there's only gold in it. Basically purify it all over again and see if it's recast it all over again. Imagine a global world economy where you have to do that. Now, I think obviously I would prefer to have that than a system in which governments get to print money. And I think even if we did that, then we spent an enormous amount of money on moving gold around and verifying it and casting it and recasting it into bars, that would still be preferable to a world in which governments just get to print money and destroy their people's savings every now and then and get to launch wars every time they want. I think it's a price well worth paying. However, it's a price that I can't get to choose to pay, because, you know, the way the gold standard works is that you need the government, you need the people who benefit from destroying the gold standard to be the ones to adopt it, which is highly unlikely to happen. Which, like with everything, like with every episode of the Bitcoin Standard podcast, brings us to the real important conclusion, which is that, of course, what fixes this is Bitcoin. So in my opinion, I think we won't have a stable equilibrium. And we've had an episode discussing this earlier. We can't have a stable equilibrium around the dollar anymore. I think the dollar's status has arguably been seriously compromised after the confiscation of Russian resources and kicking out Russia from the system and watching Russian economy basically get by without massive catastrophe. You can't have an equilibrium around the US dollar anymore, because there are people that the US dollar doesn't even want. It can't happen around the Chinese currency, because a lot of people don't like the Chinese. But more importantly, there is no free capital market in the yuan. There's no free capital market in China. You can't have a global reserve currency that doesn't have free open capital markets. So it's not clear the Chinese even want that for themselves. I think the Russians as well, obviously it's unworkable for most people that they're going to use a Russian reserve currency. And gold is going to continue to be expensive and unworkable, because all those governments don't want it. They all rather have their own currency. And that just leaves the one thing that continues to operate without their permission, the one thing that anybody can use in Russia or in the US or in China or in South Africa or in Chile or in Norway or in New Zealand. Anywhere in the world, anybody can use it. And anybody who uses it, you know, you can't get your assets frozen. You can't get frozen out. You can't get sanctioned. There's nobody out there to decide what you get to say and do in your life. It doesn't allow you to print money, but it doesn't allow others to print money and rob your wealth or take away your money. So what are your thoughts on Bitcoin, and what do you think in terms of the use of Bitcoin in Russia in these days?
Right now, we don't have any regulations on Bitcoin in Russia, but I hope it will come very soon, because of all this situation, cryptocurrency occurred like a saver, because it's safe, it's quick, it's very fast transactions. And, you know, as you said, you have, you know, your
private key.
Yeah, your crypto wallet into your pocket, and nobody can take it. It is not gold. It is not in bank accounts that can be frozen or anything else. So you have your wallet and you put it into your pocket, and there are your money. So it seems very safe right now, especially for Russian people. And right now it is very popular in Russia. You know that I provide online courses as well. And I have for Russian people right now, it's very popular cryptocurrency course. It's very popular. Everybody wants to know how to withdraw money, how to deposit money, how to open the crypto account and all this stuff, how to buy the first his or her first coin and all this stuff. Because right now for Russian people, it's like the, you know, open a door, because all the other doors are closed. So I think that cryptocurrency is our future, that's starting right now. I'm glad that we have this alternative. And it's really awesome. So I'm, you know, I vote for Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously here we are going to very much agree with you. Do you see people beginning to use it for trade, for businesses? Are businesses using it as a way of settling with foreigners? I mean, I'm sure that people are still trading. You know, I think the seaports in Russia still work, right? Like if you have a ship, it can leave Russia, and I'm pretty sure there is shipping going to other countries, right? To European countries. And no shipping?
It's forbidden as well.
All shipping has been stopped?
Ports. No port except Russian ships right now.
Oh, wow.
Yes. That's why I say we don't have import, we don't have export at all. That's why nobody buys dollars in Russia. There is nowhere to spend it at all. That's why it's very popular. Crypto became very popular right now in Russia because we can buy at least something for crypto. You know that, for example, Dubai right now, they offer to buy real estate for Bitcoin. You just can, you know, transfer your money, your crypto to the company, to real estate company. And for example, the apartment is yours. So it's some kind of savings. It's some kind of diversification.
Yeah.
For example, when everything started, all this shit happened, and I understood that I have just 2 days to withdraw my money, my rubles, while the SWIFT still works and this Master and Visa card were working. You know what I did? I spent all my money in Dubai because they accepted Russian cards. They were the last who refused Russian cards.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. And now the Russian cards don't work. The Russian seaports don't work. I mean, this is extremely fascinating for me because in my mind, I could not imagine, and this is causing me to question a lot of things. I could not imagine that you could shut off the ports and shut off Russia from the SWIFT system and not get a humanitarian crisis. But I guess I would have expected this because, you know, the importance of global trade and just how important the division of labor really is. But I guess Russia probably is, if anybody's going to be an exception, it might be Russia because it's on the one hand, enormously large. It's got an enormous chunk of the world under its, what is Russia as a percentage of the Earth's surface? I think it's like a sixth or a seventh or something like that of global surface area. It's a huge chunk of the planet.
It's the largest country.
Yeah, it's the largest country in the world. So it has an enormous chunk of Earth. But also, it went through a period of extreme self-reliance and autarky, so it's never been that integrated into international trade. I would imagine if something like this were to happen to the U.S., it would be far more devastating because the U.S. is far more reliant on international trade than Russia, perhaps.
You know what? You know, America is a very interesting country, and it's a very tricky country. For example, they had, they put all these sanctions onto Russia together with Europe. And Europe, the European Union, they use all these sanctions. So if they said, we will not get something from you, they don't. But not America. You know, there were a few moments when I don't remember exactly what it was about, but it was like Europe is suffering of lack of, I don't know, gas. And America buys it from Russia. So if America wants something, it gets it.
Yeah. So what is the situation of energy like in Russia? What are fuel prices like? Are they going up as much as the rest of the world, do you think? No.
No. Yes, I know. I just came from my vacation from America. I was there 2 months. And the prices for gas is, $7 per gallon. It is ridiculous. It is, oh my gosh. No, in Russia we have the same prices as it was before. Nothing. And why? We have this gas. It is our oil. Why should it rise?
Yeah, I mean, sounds like such a strange idea. Why would you not want to produce all of this critical infrastructure? Of course, another major part of this isn't just economics. A major part of it is ideological suicide of the West. Of the green hysteria that has taken over, where people, grown adults think that carbon dioxide is going to boil the oceans or destroy everything. And therefore, the way to fix it, you know, the only way to heal the planet is to get rid of all the technologies that have made our life possible in the last 500 years, the technologies that have taken us out of the jungle and made us able to live in stable, safe homes, you know, particularly, you know, hydrocarbon fuels. It's a big part of this. It's incredible that people in Europe and the US have spent the last 20, 30, 40 years actively sabotaging their fossil fuel and hydrocarbon infrastructure. Specifically, yeah. Because they think that, you know, we can just switch to these swings and slides that are solar and wind. You know, we could just run a world economy based on the energy source that ran a medieval economy, which is windmills. You know, medieval economies ran on windmills, and that's why life was extremely difficult. That's why survival in the winter was much more difficult. That's why productivity was much, much lower than it is right now. That stuff isn't really very popular in Russia, right? People don't really buy the idea that we need to give up on oil and gas in order to save polar bears or stop the coral reef or whatever latest hysteria is. Yeah, this isn't very popular, huh?
It is popular among young people because they are more modern, they are more influenced in the, you know, internet and all this stuff. But, for example, Tesla is very popular right now in America. Every second car was Tesla when I was on my vacation. And it's cool. I really like Tesla. I really like that it's not gas, it's not oil. But in Russia, we don't have these stations, for example, for these kind of cars. We don't have these stations. And for us, it's cheaper to have oil.
No, it's cheaper. It's cheaper for everyone to have oil. It's insane how much money and subsidies go into making these electric cars work. And it's insane because in order to make an electric car functional, you need an entire grid to make it functional. You know, you need charging stations anywhere there is a road. With fossil fuels, we already have that infrastructure with gasoline and gas stations everywhere. And really, the world relies on these gas stations, and cars can only go where the gas stations are. And we can't get rid of the gas station infrastructure because we need it for long-haul trucking. And electric batteries are nowhere near being anywhere near replacing long-haul trucking. You know, you're talking about a truck that drives 18 hours nonstop. There are no batteries that can do that and can recharge as quickly as you can fill the gas tank. So we need to keep the gasoline infrastructure. So building all of the electric infrastructure is an extra cost, and it's not something that would be undertaken in the market. And that's why you don't find any adoption of electric vehicles in places where they're not very heavily subsidized. There was a story a few years ago, where in Hong Kong, they removed the tax benefit for electric car sales. There was some form of subsidy that was removed, and immediately sales dropped to zero. Yeah, maybe it's, you know, maybe the car looks nice, but not falling for things like Tesla is why you guys have cheap gasoline today. It's why critical infrastructure is more likely to work in the winter in Russia this year, because in places like Germany and California and Texas, they've spent the last 20 years trying to make solar, wind, and batteries replace natural gas, oil, and coal infrastructure.
And you know that it's said that the winter in Europe is going to be very cold this year. And actually, all the sanctions were like to shoot in your own foot from the side of Europe, because you understand that it is obvious that there will be a recession. We can already see it starting. If we still speaking about the economy, the energy crisis in Europe is progressing due to sanctions against Russia, as we said before, among all other reasons. And all these restrictive measures imposed on Russian energy supplies have worsened the European Union economy so much. They will be, and it started already, inflation in Europe, and it is already, you know, rising. And accordingly, Europe suffers the most, even though the US solves its political issues through this crisis. Europe suffers just as much as, I don't know, as even Russia, because regular people suffers. I have a lot of friends here in Europe, and they are already very terrified of the bill that comes for the electricity. It was very, for the electricity, then for the gas in the winter. A part of everything that's going on right now in Ukraine, you know, it's terrifying, it's awful, and no excuse for what's going on. if we say only about people and about economics, it's really unfair for just regular European people, because all the costs comes to them. They will pay for this.
It's very true. It's very true. And I think the reality of the matter is Europeans and Americans can moan about, oh, this is, they call it in the US, Putin's price hike. And President, what's his face? The French guy was, yeah, it doesn't matter. They're all interchangeable. He was saying something along the lines of, you know, we have to this is the end of abundance because we are being fought by an external enemy that wants to destroy our liberties. And so basically we need to give up on things because of these external enemies. And of course, every economically failed leadership and government has always blamed evil foreigners. But the reality is this is completely self-inflicted because it is self-inflicted because of the green hysteria in Europe that placed Europe at such dependence on Putin. And this is the thing. You can agree or disagree with whatever Putin has done. You can like him or dislike him. That doesn't force you to become dependent on him, except if you become a green hysteric. Except if you dismantle nuclear industry and you dismantle coal power plants and you dismantle natural gas power plants and you dismantle oil generating facilities based on the green insanity, well, then, yeah, I mean, there was an enormous underinvestment in Europe and in the US in these energy sources over the last 15, 20, 30 years because of the green hysteria. I mean, you look at most of the current crop of leaders in the US and Europe and Canada and Australia, it's a foregone conclusion for them. They talk about it as if it's just, it's, as they like to call it, it's settled science that we need to quit hydrocarbon fuels over the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years, whatever. They have some kind of ridiculous time frame where in their mind it's possible. And this is just a level of delusion that is laughable. And there will come a day in which people are going to laugh at this in truly, truly loud laughter because it's truly ridiculous. There are people out there who think we can just get rid of hydrocarbons. We can have a modern life where we willingly give up all of those things. And this has motivated investment over the last 15, 20 years. What oil company wants to put in an enormous amount of investment into a place like the US where, or Canada or Germany, where you know, the parliament and the presidency are out there reminding you every day that your industry is going to be dead sometime in the next 5, 10, 20 years. That's what prevents gas exploration in Europe. That's what makes Europe dependent on foreign gas because nobody wants to invest domestically. You're more likely to invest in gasoline in countries that aren't falling for this insane hysteria, like Russia or like the Gulf, and so like the Gulf Arab countries, because they don't really buy this stuff. So they continue to invest in gasoline. And so the world becomes dependent on them for this critical infrastructure. So it's completely self-inflicted.
And you told about hydrocarbons. I wanted to tell, I just remembered that one point about Russian economy, it's a very important point. You know, it's our feature of Russian economy is hydrocarbons. To export hydrocarbons, we need only a pipe. No factories, no plants, just pipes. There is no need to create a factory. Put in a pipe and it will work. And here is very, you know, interesting phenomenon called the Dutch disease. Have you ever heard about this?
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is right now and always have been in Russia. I will tell, if you don't mind, I will tell to our viewers what is this about.
Mm-hmm. Please.
This is when you have exports. In our case, it's hydrocarbons, but the economy is not so good. And Russian economy is not so good. It has low efficiency. And the main symptom of this Dutch disease is high volume of natural production. That leads to high level of its export that in terms leads to decreased economical growth. And why Russia has this Dutch disease, to make the long story short, our prosperity is based on hydrocarbons, which we export for money, but you know, do not pump for the economy because we do not produce the final product. You can make a lot of things out of hydrocarbons. Our difference, Russian economy, very different from other countries, is that we don't produce byproducts. even though we could make more money from them. And this is the weakness of the Russian economy. It's not a strong point at all. It's awesome that we have so many natural resources, but we are spoiled by the fact that we literally have money pumped out of the ground. So Russia doesn't make a byproduct out of your own resources. So we don't make extra profit or create additional jobs for the population. And this is a very sad story. And you started to tell about hydrocarbons. And I remember that it's every interesting point about Russian economy.
Yeah, I mean, there's a monetary element to the Dutch disease. Most of the time, the way that it is described is that because you're exporting a lot, so you bring in a lot of foreign currency, and that raises the value of your currency, and that then hurts your other exporters. It leads to your country focusing mostly on just the export of the goods. So usually it happens with just pumping natural resources or agricultural products, and it doesn't lead to much development. I think predominantly, this is arguably, I would imagine it's a fiat story. If money was gold, and gold was everywhere, then all that would happen is, you know, you export barrels of oil and you get physical quantity of gold, and other businesses are as likely to be as successful in Russia or abroad because the value of money remains the same. It's not affected by imports and exports. This is one of the major failures of the fiat system, that it trades in a token that itself goes up and down in value in a way that is quite destructive. But I want to mention something to you. You said that the only thing that you need to export hydrocarbons is a pipeline. Well, guess what? You don't even need a pipeline. You don't even need a pipeline thanks to Bitcoin. Bitcoin has invented the world's first way of selling hydrocarbon energy or any form of energy and monetizing it anywhere in the world without having to transport it. Because what you do is you just move the Bitcoin miners to the source of the energy and you connect it to the place where the energy is done. And then all you need is to just to have an internet connection by satellite that sells the hashing from the miner to the Bitcoin network effectively and generates Bitcoin. So you don't even need pipelines. You just need to put Bitcoin miners next to places where you have energy and you can get Bitcoin out of it. So it's the most low-cost way of exporting energy generally. Do you have any thoughts on Bitcoin mining or any idea if Bitcoin mining is taking place in Russia?
Yes, of course. It's taking place, but you know, in Russia, it still doesn't regulate it. So nobody knows, for example, how to pay taxes from this. You know, it's still very gray zone. And all of my friends, for example, all of my circle of my people, we pay taxes. It's our responsibility. We don't avoid it. That's why it's very complicated with cryptocurrency, with mining in Russia right now, because we are ready to pay taxes. But how?
Yeah, I mean,
but one day everything will be okay, I'm sure.
I hope so. I don't have very strong opinions about Russian tax law, so
I don't know. It's very simple.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, the Bitcoin mining thing, I would imagine, in case of energy sanctions, this is another level that frees the world away from U.S. dollar dominance in an extremely elaborate way. That this is the kind of thing that really blows people's mind when you tell them how Bitcoin works. Because if you're stuck in a place where you don't have the ability of exporting energy resources because of US sanctions, well, then you just need to run Bitcoin miners and you're able to export that energy, sell that energy to the Bitcoin network and turn it into money that you can use to get around US financial sanctions. The symmetry of it is beautiful in that Bitcoin allows the energy market to become digital, and it allows the money market to become digital and to escape into the digital realm away from politics and regulation and sanctions and all of that stuff. And so now money and energy everywhere in the world are easily fungible because you can trade them with one another easily everywhere.
And fast.
And fast, yeah.
Yeah. And it's awesome. It's really awesome.
It absolutely is. It truly is. One more question I wanted to ask you on the question of China. How do you see general kind of sentiment on the issue of dealing with the yuan and thinking of China? Is this something that people in Russia, do you think, discuss? Like they're beginning to say, all right, well, we've been sanctioned by the US, we need to start turning east. Or is there still skepticism of China? How do you see this from the perspective of the average Russian person that you know? I know this is obviously asking for too much of a generalization, but is this something that you think people are seeing as a realistic possibility, or is it just a few people that discuss it?
No, it's the real realistic possibility, firstly. And second of all, you know, last, I don't know, 10, 20 years, a lot of companies started to trade, to communicate, to interact with China. And we have a lot of Chinese goods on our market. That's why, one of the point why we didn't suffer a lot from all these companies that gone from Russia, because we have a lot of Chinese companies, Chinese goods, and a lot of companies work with each other, I said, 15, 10 years. So it's not something new. And we still have this trading communication between each other. And you know that we are neighbors, so it's easy. And because of this situation, a lot of people now saw that Chinese demonstrated the support. From this point of view, those who never thought about China, who never thought about communication or interaction to Chinese businesses, turned their head to this side.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on the way that this develops? You were mentioning that you think most likely that the ruble is probably overvalued, and you were saying that most likely that these kind of sanctions are going to start to bite and hurt later on this year moving forward. Do you have thoughts about how this develops economically moving forward?
I can tell you right now Russian economic is like 10 years before, and it's really a sad story because I was raised after Perestroika. You know, you remember Perestroika in 1991? Yeah, in 91. And when I was a child, I never couldn't understand why should I study hard? Why should I have good marks and all this stuff? Because there is the example that somebody stole something and now he's rich. And the other example that he is the daughter or the son of some politics or some, I don't know, mafia, and he succeed. And I was like, so why do I need to study? If all the success people are like this, I studied hard. I love to study. I graduated to university. I have two graduations. So in physics, in economics. And, you know, all my life was like normal life. I studied hard. Then I worked hard. I have my some benefits. I have a family. I have my businesses. And nothing went wrong. Right now, unfortunately, we're again 15 years ago, where children maybe don't understand why they should to study hard, why they should to go to the university. And it's very, very sad story about Russian economic, Russian situation right now. I don't know when it ends, how it ends, but I hope that it will end. And I hope that everything will be normal again, like in my childhood, because I can tell my kids, do you want to live like this? You should go to school. My parents couldn't say like this.
Yeah, no, this is something that I mentioned in the Bitcoin standard and in the fiat standard, which is in a hard money economy, it's the only way that you can make money is to go out there and serve other people. Well, you can also rob them, but that ends up being complicated. Eventually they catch on. It's not a sustainable business model. But with an easy money economy, all of these things become, you know, work becomes disconnected from reward. And you see an enormous amount of people who don't work, who get rewarded because they manage to be connected to the money printer, or because they manage to gamble correctly on the movements in prices and or objects. And you see a lot of people who work hard and then have their entire life destroyed for no fault of their own, just because somebody at a certain institution they had trusted with their life savings, decided to go and print a bunch of money and thought it would work out. People can see the devastating impact in terms of the individual stories. But one point that I try and emphasize in the fiat standard is to try and, because government is always trying to turn their attention away from inflation because they don't like us to think about it. So even people who get it, they only think primarily in the first order effects. And of course, the first order effects are extremely bad. You know, people's lives get destroyed and devastated. People save 20 years and then watch everything disappear. Not enough thinking is done on the second order effect, which is perhaps even as tragic, which is the fact that, yeah, when all of these people's lives get ruined, what happens to the next generation that sees them working hard and getting ruined? Why would anybody in that generation want to work hard? And so then you get generations that are built on the culture of essentially anti-civilization thinking. We are not out there building a civilization so that we can all survive and live a better, healthier, safer life together and cooperate with one another to build cities and civilization and infrastructure. No, we're out in the jungle. Essentially, we've taken the jungle back into the city. It's a war of all against all, and my plan is to try and get money from you. And we lose the concept of production as a way of generating wealth, and instead aggression becomes the way of generating wealth. It's one of the most devastating and destructive impacts of the fiat century, of this turning of money into a government loyalty scheme point rather than a reward for work. All right, we have a question from Doria.
Yeah. Hi. Lana, this was very good. A lot of information. I'm interested if you have any information if the real market in Russia, aka the black market, risen, and are like local businesses trying to smuggle their products between countries?
I didn't want to mention it, but yes, we have it right now. when I was preparing for this interview, I thought to put it into my speech or not. Yes, unfortunately, right now we have black market.
Unfortunately,
I don't like it because I don't like everything that's not regulated. It's not legal. And, you know, all this stuff, it enters Russia without any documentation or something like this. And our government, it's like closes its eyes and like nobody can see anything. It's a very sad story. I don't like this about Russia right now. And this is what I told you about a few minutes ago, that Russia right now, like 20 years ago, when it was black market, when it was currency exchange market, black market, and all this stuff. It's a very sad story. Thank you for this question.
Thank you.
I mean, obviously, it is a sad thing that you get a black market. People have to resort to this, but I think it's a better thing than the alternative, which is no black market, in which case, you know, people don't have the ability to trade, which I think is devastating. Lana, do you have anything else you'd like to add? Anything you want to tell us about your adventures with Bitcoin and Russia and all of these things?
I wanted to say to you, thank you so much for the invitation. And when you told about cryptocurrency and all the possibilities that cryptocurrency allows right now, I just wanted to add that I always say to my students, right now, crypto and Bitcoin is like money in the air. Just take it like this. And don't be afraid of this. It's something new. It's our future. Someday it was the same, unbelievable, or for example, non-understandable, like fiat. But now crypto, Bitcoin and blockchain, it's something new. And don't be afraid of this. So I hope that all your viewers, all our listeners will hear me right now. It's our future.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, I agree. And I think the way that the world unfolds just continues to play into the favor of what is better, what is the better technology. And the last couple of years continue to provide us more and more evidence of the superiority of Bitcoin in performing the functions that people want from their money. And I think this discussion here further solidifies that. Thank you so much again for joining us. Have a good day.
Thank you. Bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.